politely. Each family will define this term slightly differently, but here are some general rules of engagement that can be applied in both directions. No yelling. No global insults. How to recognize? Sentences that begin with "you always" or "you never." No interrupting the other person as soon as she begins to speak. Listen to points you don't agree with. You can tell your daughter these rules and explain, "In this house, people speak to each other politely, but it has to be true." When I work with families where the parents are frequently unkind or critical of each other in front of the children, I remind them that while they've grown accustomed to eruptions and skirmishes, the children are learning what to expect in relationships. Snarky comments often come from mom, who's criticizing dad for things he's saying to the daughter that will supposedly damage her irreparably. It's unfair, but just as when the children were younger, fathers can get away with a looser approach than moms. I tell the mothers, "I'm sorry, but he can say things that are teasing and it can feel affectionate and connected. You say the same thing and it hurts your daughter's feelings." When mom develops more tolerance for dad's verbal joshing, it's often the turning point to a higher level of civility among the entire family. If you and your partner are being polite to each other and the kids, you're on firm footing demanding the same of your daughter. She doesn't have to approve of your taste, your clothes, the questions you ask, or the food you serve for dinner. Remember, none of her behavior is permanent or predictive. Use the strategies below to establish rules of civility and end a conversation when you want to end it. Being rude or mean. Daughter screams, uses profanity, insults you. "I know you're very upset, but this is not a conversation. It feels like an attack, and it's not going to get us anywhere because I won't listen to it. When you can tell me what you want me to hear in a calmer way, I'm ready to listen." Then stop responding to her. Do not get seduced into a counterattack. Advocating a cause that's not reasonable in your view. Your ninth grade daughter says, "There's nothing to worry about. Willa's brother Miles is driving us all to Coachella. He's really nice. Don't you trust me?" Your reply can be one or more of the following. "I do have lots of confidence in you, and your judgment tends to be excellent. It's the situation I don't trust." It may be perfectly fine, but the temptation or risk or lack of supervision is not something I'm comfortable with. Not yet. With your good track record, I'm sure you can do this at some point, but I'm not ready for it yet. This is positive reinforcement instead of, "Are you kidding? Maybe in 2 years." Refusing to let a topic drop. This often turns into a daughter stalking you around the house, demanding that you engage. You can say, "This conversation needs to stop. I'm not thinking straight. Soon I'm going to say something I regret." You can tell you're running out of fuel when your thinking starts to get global and your fantasy punishments primitive. "She always flakes on the French homework just to piss me off. I'm going to ground her for a month. I'll take her phone and she won't get it back until Christmas." Don't criticize her style. Do raise her awareness. Regarding your daughter's terrible taste in makeup, nail polish, hair, or clothing, my advice is to hold your tongue. She's trying on identities, like she did when she was a little girl playing with costumes. If her style gets too extreme, the school will rein her in. She may no longer ask for your honest opinion, but if she does, and it's negative, Use the same techniques you employed for younger girls. Either play the biased mom card, you always look beautiful to me, or globalize it. That's not a look I like on anyone. Dressing in unflattering styles is painful to see, but not risky for the teenager. But what about seductive clothing? It's possible that what you perceive as clearly provocative, teensy shorts, cleavage thrusting out of a demi-cup bra squeezed under a super tight tee, does not appear to your daughter as risque. It's just fashion. If you try to instigate rules, she can change into her preferred attire as soon as she's down the block. I'm not suggesting you let her wear anything she likes. I'm just acknowledging the limits of a parent's power. As you're sending her back to her room to change into something less skimpy, it might make some impact to say in a concerned tone, "A skirt that short is going to attract the attention of men of all ages, including creepy adult guys." Don't expect her to thank you for this insight. Your goal is to place the idea in her head where, ideally, it will grow from a tiny seed of hesitation into a healthy flower of self-awareness. Teenage girls want to wear trendy outfits and feel the power of their sexuality, but they can't truly comprehend the effect tight, revealing clothing has on boys and men. Social media undermines their confidence about their physical appearance, while all media pushes highly sexualized fashions. At the same time, there's a rapidly growing awareness of the pervasiveness of sexual assault and of violations of women's rights and dignity. It's confusing for a young woman, and adult women too. How do you encourage your daughter to embrace her sexuality and develop a personal style that doesn't cheapen and objectify her body? One approach is to talk about your own aesthetic sensibilities. Whose style do you admire? There are dozens of movies with female characters that can broaden your daughter's view of women in fashion. You're not expecting her to agree with your taste today, although she might. You're giving her ideas for tomorrow. CommonSenseMedia.org has a list of classic and new releases under a wonderful category called Movies with Strong Female Characters. Watch these movies together, taking care not to let an agenda of consciousness raising crowd out your shared pleasure. What not to say to teenage girls? Olivia's mom told me she's doing a college interview boot camp this summer. Doesn't that sound like it would be so helpful? Don't use comparisons with other teenagers as inspirational hints. Enough with the upspeak. Upspeak is a sentence ending in a questioning tone. "We were going to meet at the movies and then she canceled and we had to reschedule?" Most girls outgrow this habit. You sound like a bored character on a reality show. The creaking, low-register, monotone delivery called glottal fry is irritating to many adults. Young people perceive it differently and may consider it authoritative and empowered. Do you know how often you say, like, you know, and and end sentences with the word so? Leave her alone about verbal tics and slang. Again, it's just a phase. Stop biting your nails, twirling your hair, playing with your split ends. Psychologists understand these behaviors as products of teenagers' naturally high energy with too little opportunity for release. Forced to sit through biology instead of hunting, gathering, or chasing after small children? Tapping your feet, talking nonstop during breaks between classes, leaning precariously back in your chair, vents some of this pressure. Teenagers have to move, all these habits will likely disappear on their own. What to say to teenage girls? Compliment her choices, not her looks. If you approve of something, she'll probably reject it. Opposing you gives her power. So if you want to pay her a compliment, make it about specific, observable facts, not your personal judgment. Don't say, "You look adorable in that jacket," or "I love those earrings." Instead, say, "That leather jacket looks so soft," or "Those earrings really stand out against your dark hair." Remember issues she brought up and ask her about them without offering judgment or advice. "I know you were frustrated in calculus last week. How's the new unit? Did you decide what kind of glaze you want to use on your bowl?" Take the indirect route. Broach awkward subjects or tender feelings by talking about characters in a movie or TV show. Don't be the one to point out the similarities between those fictional people and your daughter or situation she's in. If she mentions the connection or shares some insights, tread lightly. These are precious and intimate moments when your best contribution is to listen closely and murmur an occasional, "Wow, interesting." Stay open-minded. "I hadn't thought of it that way" is a powerful and liberating sentence. You can model listening and changing your mind by saying, "Good point," or "I didn't realize there would be adult staff supervising the event. Now that you told me, you can definitely go." Goodwill for teenage girls. There are reliable ways to build credit in a teenage girl's bank of goodwill, and they are surprisingly simple. Be discreet. Daughters will feel safe about sharing experiences of shame, pride, heartbreak, loneliness, love, and appreciation for their friends, and may even ask for and follow your advice if they trust that what happens between mom or dad stays with mom or dad. Get a family pet. Don't ask her to help take care of it. As with teenage boys, pets are therapeutic for adolescent girls. The dog or cat never criticizes her weight or gossips behind her back. Its love is unconditional and always accessible. She can hug it and stroke it and sleep with it. But while some girls thrive on caring for animals, others are not so eager. Some may even see dodging the pet care as a way to assert their autonomy. So just as with boys, don't insist on your daughter caring for the animal. Just be thankful for the emotional support it provides. Let her decorate her room and don't butt in. You're not obliged to buy her a fantasy bedroom, but within the budget you set, let her go wild. Give her dominion over as much as possible because she feels completely powerless. Surprise her with little gifts. This is risky because her tastes change from moment to moment, but it's worth it, especially if she's having a hard week. Say, "I remembered you admired this when we were at the mall. If you don't like it, it's easy to return." Be effusive when she does something thoughtful for you. When you see generous or kind behavior, be very appreciative. "Sweetie, I'm so grateful to you for doing this. It really gave me a lift today. Thanks. You're the best daughter ever." Chapter 9. The Opinionators. Teaming up with your partner, your ex, the grandparents, and Olivia's mom. We live in an era of bountiful resources available at the touch of a screen. When we no longer require the services of the online experts or real-life specialists we have summoned, they politely recede until the next time we need them. Not so your child's other parent or grandparents. They always have an opinion, and you will hear it. Not to mention the imagined rebukes of the other moms you see each day at the playground or at pickup. To be fair, your child's other parent deserves an equal say in the rearing of your son or daughter. Grandparents are often able to cherish and encourage a child without worrying about developmental milestones or test results. And among the other moms, you'll find not only insecure show-offs, but also intelligent, generous, loyal women who will become lifelong friends. These opinionators are your inner circle. Observing how you interact with them shapes your child's understanding of human relationships. Human means imperfect, hopeful, extraordinary, fallible, a work in progress. Talking to your partner about your child. The push and pull between mother and father is an ancient dance that's revised every decade. Roles mutate as the nuclear family strains to accommodate modern pressures and the definition of average household expands to include two moms or dads, college graduates returning to live at home, moms as primary breadwinners. Yet despite the changes, most families are still founded on a set of two parents. And that means two perspectives on child rearing multiplied by a thousand ways to disagree. From infant to high school senior, your child is listening. When you were growing up, you were alert to how your parents greeted each other at the end of the workday. You sensed the warmth or tension between them, and it reassured or rattled you. You know your children do the same. So try to be a model of maturity and forbearance, no matter the mounting store of grudges or frustration you've tucked away. Then you curse yourself for failing. What is reasonable to expect of yourself or your partner? Let's begin with what is not necessary to be a successful parent. It's not necessary to be right about your child-rearing decisions. And I don't mean right compared to your spouse. I mean right, period. There is no right. The perfect solutions to this week's crisis might not work, or they'll work for some families and not others. They'll work on Monday but not Tuesday. Families are evolving organisms. It's not necessary to present a unified front to your children. There's a myth that if they see a crack in the wall of mom and dad, they'll either exploit it or get scared. But it all depends on how you disagree. Civilized debate and compromise is a skill you can model for your children. It's not necessary to always use your inside voice. Some families are hot, some are cool. Some homes are full of noisy verbal jousting, and others are mellow. Some families enjoy merry self-mockery, others delight in gallows humor. There's room for every flavor as long as the foundation is respect. When it comes to raising children, no two parents will have identical sensibilities about appropriate levels of risk, fun, manners, or enrichment. But when one of them harbors a deep commitment to unearthing the very best choice and deep ambivalence about what it might be, the less anguished parent is often seen not as sensible, but as neglectful or disloyal. In a great many of my sessions with parents, I find myself repeating, "It doesn't matter." Yet we're living in an era where parents behave as if it all matters, as if every decision is life and death. We parents have a huge investment in the quality of our children's lives, but it's not an entirely noble impulse. Their well-being has become a proxy for our fears about the future and our dissatisfaction with ourselves, our partner, work, sex, aging, in-laws, and money. It all gets displaced onto the children, and arguing about them stands in for other conversations we should be having. It's made worse by the culture's frantic pace. Urgent feels normal. When a disagreement with our partner arises, we rush in to settle it instantly. No room for reflection, no time for compromise, no bandwidth for asking ourselves, could my spouse be right? Why am I reacting this way? Proxy battles and how to recognize them. In the average family, where no one is profoundly mentally ill, addicted, or abusive, most arguments about the children are proxy battles. The proxy battle is usually triggered by emotional wounds, mostly unconscious, from your own childhood. You're reliving and trying to correct the mistakes your parents made, and your partner is doing the same thing. Women, and some men, get into the habit of feeling victimized, carried over from a childhood where they had too little power or respect. Men, and some women, feel pushed around and confined, their confidence diminished, their playfulness stifled, carried over from a childhood where they worked hard to please a critical parent. These are only two of countless examples. It's not possible to cleanse your memory and nervous system of all prior experience and solve each of your child's dilemmas through pure reason. Besides, those memories don't only result in neuroses and bitterness. They're also what's made you the insightful, patient, and soulful parent you are on your better days. At the same time, you can learn to recognize when legitimate concern over a child is overlapping with hurts from your past or other unrelated issues. It's best if you can catch yourself doing this before you start discussing it with your partner, but it's easier to see the connection when you're trying to explain yourself out loud. As always, tone is the first warning. Is your pitch rising? Do you sound dismissive, contemptuous, offended? How does your body feel? Is your heart pounding? Is your throat tight? Are you clenching your hands, shaking your head, or jiggling your leg impatiently? Is your breathing shallow? Listen to your words. Are you saying, you always, you never, I can't believe you? When you notice these signals, pause. Put the conversation on hold. This may be extraordinarily difficult because the problem is going to feel like a calamity and you're late for something, and why hesitate when you know you're right? All the more reason to wait for a window of time when both you and your partner are rested, fed, and have 15 minutes or more to devote to the conversation. Aside from a medical emergency, just about everything can wait. Basic manners and voice lessons for parents. My mantra for both mothers and fathers is, stop worrying about the influence of the other parent and concentrate on your own behavior. For example, understanding that children tolerate gruffer behavior from fathers than from mothers can help you mentally shift from alarmed to reflective. He just yelled at her to stop climbing the refrigerator like a monkey and get the hell out of the kitchen. Not what I would say, but his tone was light. Let's see how she reacts. A sense of humor and trust in the good intentions of the other person build a more relaxed and loving home. The surest way for parents to sustain this healthy perspective is by observing some old-fashioned manners. For instance, just as mom holds her tongue regarding the monkey comment, dad resists treating mom like a servant, mocking her or correcting her. The parents are consistently decent toward each other. They don't insult, curse, or bully each other. This models appropriate behavior for the kids, and it also signals that the parents are on the same team, even if they sometimes disagree, which makes the children feel safe. Good manners for parents are the same whether you're a couple or are parenting separately, assuming that an objective third party would find both parents decent and well-meaning. You don't have to fake affectionate feeling or kiss your ex hello, but you can still be polite and respectful. Manners are behaviors, not feelings. Traditionally, manners consisted of a lot of artificial-seeming rules about forms of address, who stands first, who pulls out a chair for whom. Though they may appear arbitrary, these rules meant that everyone knew what to do. They kept the social gears lubricated. In the same way, there are fundamental rules of conduct and vocal delivery that will make for a smoother, more gratifying relationship with your partner. Speak audibly and clearly, but don't yell. Limit shouting from other rooms. Keep your shoulders relaxed. No finger pointing, frustrated shrugs, or what the fuck gesticulation. Say please and thank you automatically and often. Use the person's name or an affectionate nickname at the beginning or end of a comment or question. When your partner is leaving the house, bid him or her farewell. When arriving home, wait in the car or on the street for a few moments. Take some deep breaths. Oxygenate your brain and body. Make your entrance without trailing in friction from the office. When your partner returns home, stop looking at the screen and swivel your chair or get up to greet him or her. Give a hug, a kiss, or a pat. If you're on the phone, end the call. Do this even if you're talking to your mother about your child. Don't greet the returning partner with a list of chores or reports of a child's missed behavior or crisis. Resist interrupting the other person when he or she is telling a story, even one you've heard before. Listen without vetting it for child-safe content. Don't debate the facts or steal the punchline. At the dinner table, assign each family member a permanent seat. Children should not sit in their parents' chairs. Let them look forward to this honor when they become parents themselves. Tone and body language carry more meaning than content. Groans, sighs, and smirks telegraph resentment, suspicion, or condescension. Other behaviors to avoid. Mumbling or speaking so softly that the other person must walk over to you to hear you. Vague or noncommittal responses. Stop worrying, it'll get done. Delays in decision-making. Forgetting what has been agreed upon. Uttering the guaranteed to irritate, fine, or the teenaged, whatever. Civil disagreements. In a marriage, your partner is always in close-up. As the image becomes sharper, it's easy to see the flaws. You assumed your spouse would forever retain all the qualities you fell in love with. Instead, the two of you keep changing as you grow older. Friction is unavoidable. You're going to disagree, but you don't have to fight. And you don't need to put on an act for the children. It's good for them to see how you deal with conflict. The unity you present to them isn't a facade of clenched-jawed cheeriness and rigid rules. It's a habit of unwavering, respectful communication. It starts with an awareness of nonverbal signals. When you disagree with your spouse, do so directly and verbally, not with covert grimaces or eye rolls to the kids. No head in hands indicating disbelief over how dumb men are. No raised eyebrows or open-mouthed astonishment mimed to the children as the other parent leaves the room. You don't want to conspire with your child against your partner. If you can't help but express your surprise and dismay over something your partner has said or done, do it to his or her face and, if possible, with a touch of humor. Yikes! You're taking the kids swimming now? Your parents are coming over for lunch. What? You don't want to see them? Be generous in your assumptions. Maybe the other person forgot the plans. When criticizing the other parent, first acknowledge what he or she did right. Aim for candor without rancor. If you're too angry or if the proxy battle alarms start ringing, say, I can tell that if we talk about this any longer, I'm going to say things I regret. Or, we're not going to be able to solve this now. I'm too tired. I had a hard day. I definitely want to get back to it. We can talk it over after the kids are in bed, or tomorrow, or over the weekend. If you don't agree, but don't want to argue or delay a decision, say, I'm going to defer to you on this one. I'm not sure it's the best course of action, but let's try it. If the kids are there, Mom and I disagree about this, and it's an important topic. We're going to think about it, discuss it some more, and then we'll let you know what we decide. Don't treat your spouse as a foolish clown who's refusing to bow to your superior wisdom, or as a fun hater who's always out to spoil a good time. Certain recurring situations warrant your taking a child aside and having a conversation about the other parent's temperament, all the while keeping it respectful. You know how traffic frustrates Dad. It's best not to talk to him while he's driving. Or, you know how Mom is before she has to teach a new class. She's concentrating and can't give you her full attention. Come to me if you need help or have a question. Children may not recognize these predictable traits or patterns on their own, so this kind of familiar, even affectionate talk teaches them that being sensitive to another's temperament is a good way to avoid emotional landmines. When a disagreement with your partner starts to heat up, the best way to avoid escalating it into an argument is by practicing active listening. That means paying full attention to the other person, not just waiting for a chance to jump in with your own comment or selectively listening for things that prove how wrong your partner is. Psychologist Harriet Lerner, author of the classic The Dance of Anger, says we automatically listen for negatives. You can tell you're defensive if you're listening for inaccuracies, distortions, or exaggerations instead of what you would agree with. You don't have to correct everything you disagree with. You don't have to cross-examine or nitpick. You're going to give the other person the benefit of the doubt. All this is more likely to happen if you make a practice of not diving into the argument the moment it erupts, but waiting until you've both cooled down. And if you end up saying things you regret, you can always ask, "Can I have a do-over?" Scenes from A Modern Family. What do we fight about when we fight about kids? Oh, everything. Grades, food, their friends, athletic potential, screen time, devices, bedtime, the importance of religious school, the money we're spending on them. When they're teenagers, tension revolves around all of the above, plus spending, curfews, clothes, cars, and accountability. Often, one parent makes excuses for the child or shrugs off bad behavior, while the other is astonished that parent number one doesn't see the pattern and the swift downhill trajectory of the child. There is no set of commandments that will resolve the top 10 parenting arguments, but parents can clear the debris so conversations about these topics become more comfortable. Most of the couples I see have common blind spots and assumptions about each other's feelings and motivations. Their stories are almost like set pieces from a repertory company. Same plot and script, different actors. Some of the scenes relate directly to issues such as sleep and bedtime. Others are habits so ingrained that the parents don't realize they're blocking the way to more fruitful discussions. Here are the situations I most often encounter. Musical beds and bedtime rituals. At night, the child gets into the parent's bed and the dad moves to the couch. Or the child gets scared and the dad climbs into the child's bed. A related pitfall is the bedtime ritual that ate the marriage. Father, our 5-year-old, Maya, won't go to sleep unless my wife does an elaborate bedtime ritual. She has to sing certain songs in a certain order, help Maya arrange her stuffed animals at the foot of the bed, read to her for half an hour, and finish up by checking under the bed and in the closet for monsters. The whole routine takes longer and longer every night. Me, how long? Father, up to an hour and a half. And then Maya gets up a couple of times in the night and comes into our room. She insists that her mom walk her back to her room. Mother, she screams if I don't comfort her before bed. She's afraid. I don't know why Jeff can't understand that. Father, I'm afraid too. I'm afraid for this marriage. I don't know why you can't understand that. At issue here are habits of dignity and mutual respect. Everyone is so frightened of strong emotions, as if no child should ever be scared of the dark, and no parent should ever have to experience their child being scared, that they take the easy way out, which is to be a human blankie. Then it becomes a habit, and the parent's sleep and privacy are sacrificed. In some marriages, everyone agrees on a family bed. But among the couples I've counseled, there is much resentment from fathers about the children encroaching on the parent's bedroom. The child's nighttime jitters can also be a handy camouflage for the parent's eroding intimacy. Playing blame badminton. Parents often think a child's problem traits are a direct result of their partner's bad behavior, which they see as an intentional choice. But is your spouse's behavior really so careless, dangerous, or cruel? Or is he or she simply doing things differently than you would? Our culture leads us to believe one false move can ruin a child forever. So parents turn on each other, often sarcastically and in front of the children. Nice move! Your honest answer to his question about what happened to the prisoner's head after it was chopped off by the guillotine is something he can't unhear. I see you caved into her demand for waffles. When she gets a mouthful of cavities, it's on you. You are still putting on his socks and shoes? Really? Blaming the other person can be tempting because you feel like you're taking action in a situation over which you actually have little power. Parents are helpless about children going through developmental phases. They can't change their children's temperament or influence the outside forces, good and ill, that affect them. One of the paradoxes of parenting is that you have only limited control, yet feel all the responsibility. That's why the blame starts pinging back and forth. Mom's in love with her little buddy, and Dad's out in the cold. Father's become especially resentful and inhibited when Mom so clearly prefers spending time with her son. Part of the reason mothers are so smitten is that the child is a younger, cuter, more malleable version of the husband. In today's style of parenting, no amount of together time is too much, and that provides new cover for the ancient rivalry between father and son for the mother's love. Mother is very close to her daughter, too, but they do bicker, and Dad usually shares her deep affection for the little girl. The rivalry, if it exists, is subdued. In my sessions with couples who are struggling over mom's devotion to her little boy, I'll sometimes say to the wives, you know, Aiden's going to grow up and fall in love with another girl. Tom's really cute, too, and he's the one who'll still be hanging out with you. If the spotlight you're shining on your child is so bright that your husband is left in the shadows, consider expanding your view. Do something! But what? A mother complains to a father about the child or an event involving the child, and the father thinks she wants him to do something about it. He doesn't know what to do, and he's not fully committed to the idea that something needs to be done, so an argument erupts. Often, though, the mom just wants him to listen. The stereotype is that men take action and women are more circumspect, but among modern parents, the roles are frequently reversed. It's the mothers who want to jump in and solve the problem right away. In these cases, an option for the father, or the more tranquil partner, is to be quietly supportive or noncommittal. I'm not entirely sure why you're so upset, but I respect your opinion. Texting a news scroll of irritations. Parents sometimes fall into a habit of texting each other a stream of child-oriented complaints. She left her racket at the court. Stella says Mona posted an ugly picture of her. Fever 100.5 now. This is outsourcing your distress when you haven't metabolized it or tried to solve it on your own. The news feed stokes the coals of parental anxiety and doesn't give a couple time to miss each other. When they reunite at the end of the workday, what do they talk about? All those minor problems. Technology in the bedroom. Diving into your online world is a solitary journey. You may occasionally share a funny video with your partner, but then you get sucked back into your social networks, news sites, or communiques from work. Although neither person may intend it, a custom of tuning out each other while unwinding can lead to one or both partners feeling isolated and ignored. All committed couples must decide how to balance the allure of the internet against that of the person with whom they share a life. Unplugging when you get into bed may feel awkward at first, but those few moments each night when you get to be alone together are too valuable to lose. Elevating the atmosphere. We cherish our children and put much effort into cultivating their social, academic, and creative skills. Then we look over at our spouse and give a weary shrug. There's no energy left for the grown-ups to nurture each other. Elevating the atmosphere in your home requires devoting a percentage of your effort to your partner instead of your child. A teaching I found in Christian pastoral counseling literature is a brilliant example. It suggests that every morning before a couple parts ways, they ask each other, "What can I pray for you today?" This allows them to connect deeply for a moment as they either leave the safety of the home and go out into the world or prepare to manage the children and household. At the end of the day, the parents get back together and ask if their prayers worked. This little ritual nourishes what spouses need most in each other, a loving partner who cares deeply about them but doesn't feel responsible for their challenges. Bringing God into it can be a metaphor, a way of saying, "What's on your mind?" And when the person comes home, "How did that go?" With or without the prayer, parents can ask these questions. Deciding to change some of your self-talk is another way to subtly lift the atmosphere. Just as you train yourself to view your children with the slightly detached interest of an anthropologist, you can do the same with your partner. What are the ways of this tribe? Among my clients, differences in perspective trigger knee-jerk assumptions. Fathers tell me, "My wife has far too much information about the kids. She can't be objective. She's exaggerating," or simply, "She's crazy." Moms say, "It's so clear the damage his parents did to him," or, "He's absolutely on the spectrum," or, "He's never around the children and doesn't know what he's talking about." Instead, when your partner says or does something that plucks at your parental anxiety, you can say to yourself, "That's interesting," and to your spouse, "Tell me more," or, "I hadn't thought of it that way. Help me understand." A few condescending looks or words can do considerable damage to your relationship, but tiny packets of gratitude are equally powerful. Another elevated habit for parents, including those who are divorced, is staying alert to traits or events for which you or your child truly appreciate the other parent. Then tell that parent, "I'm so glad he inherited your singing voice. When she got home, she was so excited about going roller skating again. He loves the movie. Thanks for taking him. You taught her how to use a power drill. I wish my dad had taught me." If you're divorced, you may think you'll sound phony or that these comments won't have much impact. But they'll disarm your ex, lower tension levels, build trust, and increase the chance that he or she will consider your point of view or be accommodating when your plans suddenly need to change. My final suggestion for elevating the atmosphere is to resist the unhealthy lure of detailed conversations about your child's progress and promise. Lively discussions about topics that have nothing to do with your child are more important than dissecting the talent of his third-grade teacher. Your child's teachers, friends, and obsessions will soon dissolve into history, to be replaced by next year's edition. You probably need to be talking less about your child, not more. Talking to your ex. Parenting separately has become commonplace, which is not to say it's any easier than it was decades ago when divorce carried a heavy stigma. Some exes grow into amicable blended families after time has passed. Others remain at war, but in the early days before rules and routines have been established, most parents struggle. You're still mom and dad, but no longer husband and wife, because unendurable conflict, disappointment, betrayal, or failure to communicate drove you apart. Now you're free from some of the old frustrations, but forced to encounter new ones. What's fair? How is on time defined? What about clean, rested, protected from unwholesome influences? Effective communication with an ex requires diplomacy, and diplomacy requires strategy. Even when you're heartbroken, dizzy, and still nursing fresh wounds. A helpful mindset for displaying a non-threatening and supportive attitude when talking with your ex about the kids. Pretend your child is a dog. If you were placing your Labradoodle in the care of a friend for the weekend, your instructions might be, Muzzy has been having some trouble with her tummy. It might have been her food. She seems to be better now. I took her for a walk this morning. See you Sunday night, and thanks. Some parents have a tendency to be less than candid with their ex about little crises or bouts of illness. Neither parent wants the other to think something's gone badly on their watch. Others tend to overdirect. The Labradoodle trick helps you deliver the basic information and then relinquish control. I wanted to let you know she's been crying every night about the breakup with Luke. This may continue, or she may feel better when she's in a different environment. Or, she's incredibly worried about the history final, and that's why she looks stressed. But not. Therefore, you've got to make sure she studies at least 2 hours a night. I'm sending her with the flashcards. Put them in two different piles. Make her go through the whole set at least once each day. Don't make your child play messenger or spy. Divorced parents sometimes try to avoid direct contact with each other by communicating via the children. Every marriage and family counselor warns against this, but it can take superhuman self-discipline. It's so easy to say, remind your mom that I'll be out of town next weekend. What could possibly go wrong? Item number one on a long list, your child could forget. Texting is an efficient way around the problem, but remember only to text information that falls within previously agreed upon parameters, pickup times, playdate addresses, or, and this is the outer limit of text-appropriate communication, a respectfully phrased request for schedule changes. Never text emotionally. I see text wars between ex-spouses all the time. Team husband and his new opinionated girlfriend against team wife, along with her friends and maybe her mother. They're all parsing the meaning of the text. Texting is an impulsive medium and email is a cold one. So if you can't control yourself when texting, stick to a brief but friendly email or the phone. Just don't use your child as a messenger. When a child gets home after staying with the other parent, it's tempting to launch a cross-examination in the guise of a happy-go-lucky interview. So, where was the dinner? What did you order? Did mom's new boyfriend sleep over? Children aren't fooled no matter how offhand the delivery. They know they're being asked to spy, and it makes them feel disloyal and trapped. And criticizing the ex can drive children to be protective of their mom or dad, pushing them prematurely into an adult role. Confiding to your child about the separation, divorce, or ongoing tensions is similarly unhealthy. Even though children will never protest, may give great advice, and may even feel special and grown up, placing them in this role burdens them, stealing more from the carefree quality of childhood than they've already lost through the breakup of their family. Don't intrude, do engage. You'll earn a nod of appreciation if you refrain from calling or texting your child or ex when they're together. It's easy to rationalize it as a reassuring dose of love. Night, sweetheart. But it can be an intrusion. You don't know the rhythm of the moment or the activity you're interrupting. Contacting your child conveys lack of trust, and is sometimes spurred by unconscious envy or your pang of loneliness. And it's unnecessary because bad news travels instantly. You'll know if they need you. One last habit that will foster goodwill in both your ex and your child. Take a moment when picking up or dropping off to initiate a brief chat about something that has nothing to do with the kids or logistics. It can last as long as the two of you are able to sustain a friendly tone. 30 seconds or 30 minutes are both fine. And when you leave, you can drop one of those genuine compliments that relate to your child. Can you believe the amazing model she made of a city street? Looks like she inherited your talent for engineering. Forging bonds with the grandparents. Chef Massimo Bottura attributes his love of cooking to his deep ties to a cherished grandmother. When his older brothers would torment and tease him, he recalls, "My safety place was in the kitchen, under the table, where my grandmother was rolling pasta. She'd shoo the brothers away with her mozzarella, a 3-foot-long rolling pin, shouting, 'Leave him alone, he's the young one.' From under the table, Massimo would watch flour drifting down, and when his grandmother turned her back to gather ingredients, he'd reach up and steal fresh tortellini." Hearing Bottura talk about this table as a source of shelter and nourishment, I thought about the division of emotional labor in families. His nonna didn't feel an obligation to build the character of her grandson. "Boys, sit down right now and listen. It's not nice to scare your little brother. How would you feel if someone did that to you? Massimo, you mustn't steal food." Instead, she went about her work while standing up for love and freedom and the vulnerability of the young. In the best-case scenario, where your parents are living, engaged with your family, and sane, they will provide that kind of uncomplicated devotion to your child. But often, it's not so simple. Changing values and attitudes about health and safety leave both sides frustrated. The grandparents find the parents' worries and restrictions bizarre, and the parents find the grandparents' ignorance and relaxed attitude dangerous. Your parents may be hurt and puzzled when you ignore their advice or insist they abide by your rules. "Why is our daughter so cranky, rigid, and paranoid? Only organic food, organic cotton too?" And as the child gets older, "What's wrong with drinking from the garden hose, building a fort with real wood and nails, getting some street smarts on an actual street?" Certain issues, like food allergies, tutors, and specialty summer camps, are especially controversial. Grandparents are perplexed by how delicate the child is and how neurotic the parents are. The price of the tutors and camps strikes some grandparents as outrageous, the need doubtful. Another point of contention is therapy or medication for the child. Grandparents tend to be of two schools, neither very compassionate toward the parent. It's either, "Why didn't you do it sooner?" or, "Are you crazy? That's what children are like. It's the way you handle it that's making it worse." Meanwhile, parents think the grandparents are so out of touch with current childbearing challenges that their opinions are nearly worthless. It's true that the world you grew up in was very different from the one in which you're raising your child, and that grandparents are easily confounded by the shifting challenges. They think you're exaggerating problems, and in some cases they may be right, but often they're wrong. Still, there's a silver lining to this conflict. Grandparents and grandchildren have the best human relationship that exists, because they have a common adversary, you, and neither one wastes too much time worrying about sugar or paraben-free shampoo. Plus, they're in love. You can reap a lot of benefits from encouraging this love affair, and so can your child. If you don't count against them the fact that they're not exactly like you, most grandparents are perfectly serviceable in the role. They have the patience to listen to a preschooler's rambling and